There's a man walking round the island with a snake king. Picked it up in Thailand from a hurricane. And you know he's not gonna go there. He's been one time too long. Now all the gods are gone.
Welcome to Radio Free Canada. I'm your host, Kevin Annett, and that was Phil Oakes, radical folk singer from the 60s, who died under questionable circumstances in 1975, another so-called suicide. And nevertheless, his voice carries on. He's going to be singing to us today, and that, I think, summed up what we're all about. Start of another age here in the land of Kanata and around the world. People seizing back their land and the laws from the corporatocracy that is imposing itself over our planet. Now, with me today is my regular co-host, Ryan Gable, and also commentator Laurie O'Rourke, a veteran activist in our campaign to expose and bring to trial genocide in Canada. Now, I do have an announcement, a couple of things before we start, and it's news that has come to us this week from across our land, our many nations. One of them is, I guess you could call it a little ad, for a free barbecue. We call it the Loaves and Fishes event in London, Ontario. Now, that's going to be on the 24th of this month, and what's interesting is it's going to be on the lawn of St. Paul's Anglican Church in London, Ontario. Now, that is the main one right on Richmond Street. It's also very near to the place that they house the records of the crimes they committed in various residential schools across the country that they're sitting on and won't let anybody see. Now, that day, they're having a barbecue for members of the Synod, and in case you folks are wondering what a Synod is, it's when, to an Anglican or a Catholic, it's when all the bishops get together and pretend they're serving God by talking about their money, etc. And that synod is going to be happening May 24th to 26th in London. We figured that as a movement to stop genocide in Canada, it was only fitting that we show up for the event. So there'll be a presence there by members of the Republic and the Common Law Movement. And we invite all of the poor and homeless in London, Ontario, to show up for all the free food that day. So that's apparently in the evening. Come for dinner time. Bring your knives and forks and also questions to the church as to where they're hiding the bodies and the documents. That's on the May 24th in the evening, St. Paul's Anglican Church in London, Richmond Street. London, Ontario, that is not London, England, although we are also going to be over in London doing something similar, and we'll talk about that later in the show, because London is, of course, the source for a lot of these crimes, and it's also the headquarters of something called the New England Company, which ran these so-called residential schools where so many children died and were experimented on. Also, something to ask, since we're in the vicinity talking about churches, you might ask the Marsh Insurance Company, based on Bay Street in Toronto, why they are providing insurance coverage for the Anglican and United churches when they've committed these crimes. We're asking the insurance companies in Canada to explain how it is that they get to legally insure criminal corporations. So we're going to also be talking about that today. One of the Achilles' heels of these corporations, of course, is their insurance liability. That's another thing to think of. Also, a very interesting report from North Central Alberta. Now, you guys and gals out there might have heard that there was a whopping election turnover this week in Alberta. Prime Minister Stephen Harper's own Tory backyard went NDP. They went from, what was it, 4 or 6 seats up to 53 seats. They threw out the Tories, and now we have a new Democratic Party in power in Alberta for the first time in history. Now, that's not so much, I think, a statement about the NDP as the fact that people are sick and tired. And to give you an example, groups of farmers we're working with in Alberta are literally at the point of revolting over these fraudulent mortgages and the theft of their land by crooked judges working with these mortgage companies. The same kind of thing we get all through the states. There is a group forming around Camrose, Alberta, and also based in Edmonton, that's working with our Republic, that is organizing farmers in that area, and they're going to be having meetings over the next while. If you want to get a hold of them or any of the groups and movements we're mentioning today, write to us, Republic of Kanata, K-A-N-A-T-A, Republic of Kanata at gmail.com, and our website, kanatarepublic.ca. Out on the West Coast, we do have people still gathering information to convene a common law court into the Pacific Rim child trafficking going on. That's in the works as we talk. And of course, as I mentioned, in southern Ontario, central London and Toronto area, there is a campaign to expose not only the genocide that occurred in the residential schools, but the arrest of the guilty officers who have been convicted under common law courts. And in particular, two we're focusing on, Fred Hiltz, the primate, I love that term, primate, of the Anglican Church, and Bob Bennett, Bishop of London, Huron Diocese. So we'll be talking more about that today. A final note on reports. We have a growing movement. As a matter of fact, over a third of our members are based in Quebec. And the people there have talked about holding a separate French language convention because of so much innate support there is for breaking ties with the monarchy in Quebec. There is a movement developing there to hold their own convention, Francophone convention, in the spirit of Louis-Joseph Papineau, who took up arms against the crown in 1837 alongside William Lyon Mackenzie in southern Ontario or upper Canada. And thanks to my great-great-great-grandfather, Philip Annett, who also took up arms with Mackenzie, we know something in our family about that. So that's all news coming from across Canada. And like I say, write to us, republicacanada@gmail.com, for more information on any of that and to link up with those activities. Hello, Ryan, are you there?
I am here, Kevin. I was just listening to all of the different things going on. It's a lot of stuff.
Yes. And it's really, you know, this border, of course, is fictitious. But, you know, every time I go across the states, I get the same kinds of stories, especially in the Midwest. People are very, really at end of the rope in many ways. And they keep asking, well, what do we do now? And, of course, everything is always about somebody breaking the ice and leading by example. So that's very much what we're doing. But to lead, we need knowledge. And this is what we want to talk about today. Some of the things that came up last week, I think, are important. We're talking about crimes against humanity in Canada. What is the source of a lot of these things? And you, of course, have knowledge of that, of historically where a lot of this stuff comes from, not just out of the mind of some child-raping priest, but it's right in the system itself.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And last week we talked a little bit, and I mention it from time to time, about history and how important history is to understand. And if you can examine history from an unbiased point of view and can try to piece together the stories, because we know obviously history is written by the victor, as they say. So if you can kind of piece together the stories, understand in a historical context, unbiasedly, what took place in the past, it makes it a little bit easier to understand what's taking place in the present, because a lot of the crimes I think that we're talking about, this isn't something that happened a decade ago, 2 decades ago, 3 decades ago. It's something that happened then, and it's continuing to happen now. And by observing the evidence for the past, we can see the evidence for this taking place in the present.
That's exactly right. And, of course, we want to welcome Lori O'Rourke back on the show. Hi, Lori. It's great to have you back. Assuming that you've been unmuted, maybe you haven't yet, but Lori will be on with us. When you mentioned that things still going on today, you know, people talk a lot about Bohemian Grove. There's a lot on the internet about that, arcane rituals and that. But what people don't realize is that, of course, there's a group called the Ninth Circle, and they've been operating for several centuries, according to our information. And they involve very top officials of the Vatican, the Church of England, and they're child trafficking and child sacrificial rituals connected to them. Now, what we found through some of the people who we work with in Holland, they found documents showing a direct link between the European royal families, not just the English, but the Dutch and Belgian royal families and these Indian schools in Canada. In fact, Queen Beatrix of Holland and her children were, as people know, given sanctuary in Canada during the war when the Nazis took over the country. And they were given, a fellow in Amsterdam handed me a document he found, an actual order in council. Now, for folks who don't know what that is, an order in council is when the Privy Council officers in Canada or in England get together and say, hey, we're going to have this law. We don't need it voted on by that useless thing called Parliament. We're just going to invoke this law ourselves. And it's an order in council brought in without the permission of anyone, really. And it allowed the Dutch royal family while in Canada to be exempt from any prosecution for anything. They were above the law. And, you know, if you're going to engage in these criminal activities with small children, of course, that comes in handy. So it's interesting, these things that keep coming up.
Yeah, these institutions, these corporations, they love to do things like that, the influencing of the government institutions. Like here in the States, we have vaccine manufacturers, for example, are no longer allowed to be sued when someone gets a vaccination and they get ill or their children dies. They're no longer allowed to sue the federal government or the vaccine manufacturer. It's against the law to do that.
That's thanks to Obama. I think he brought in an executive order about that.
Right, exactly. That's what I was going to mention is the executive orders. We're just passing them out like they're candy. Just every time we want to pass something that Congress, the Senate, the people don't agree with, the president just gets out his pen and gets out a paper, and he just decides to sign it himself.
Right. Now, I think that's why they had a revolution, to kind of stop that kind of executive action.
Yeah, you think so? I try to explain that to people in a historical context. And, you know, I remember when I was in high school, which wasn't too long ago, and being taught absolutely nothing about history, or at least the history that truly mattered. And regardless of people's views on human rights, God-given rights, government rights, just in the context of understanding the Bill of Rights in the United States, no kid in my high school that I remember had even heard of what the Bill of Rights were. It's not even something that was taught in my high school.
Well, exactly. Go ahead, Laura.
Well, that's just it. I mean, in Canada as well, we go through our entire schooling, graduate from high school and not know a thing about our laws, our rights, our constitution, how things actually work. There's nothing. None of that is taught.
Gee, I wonder if that's an accident.
Yeah, and we have too many we have too many politicians acting as lawyers writing different laws. We don't need more laws. We need a revolution and an elimination of these laws. Too many laws, too many restrictions, too many people in prison, and we need to eliminate this massive amount of laws and rules and regulations. It kind of puts people into different boxes. It puts people into different situations where everybody's classified as being a criminal almost.
Well, right. That's exactly what they're doing, too, though, because they're making that a profitable thing as well, right?
Yeah, we find that, too, in the, one of the many threads that led to the Declaration of the Republic and the establishment of a different kind of jurisdiction in Canada is that, something as basic as the rule of law, it doesn't really operate. And people don't know that until they come into the courts, so-called courts in Canada. The most recent example, Dean Clifford, how they were denying him habeas corpus. He couldn't file a habeas corpus writ for his case to be brought into court. They had him in jail for over, 16 months without any charges. That can happen anytime. And so, people often say, well, we've never really had the rule of law in Canada. We've never had accountability. We have people elected to Parliament who take an oath of allegiance to an old woman in London, but not to the people or to the Constitution. So, if Canada is ever to be judged for its crimes, it can't be judged by Canada. It's got to be judged by Kanata, we the people. And that's the whole purpose of all this. And we have no better example than that than what we experienced in Brantford, Ontario, with this mushhole dig. And the thing we want to focus on and maybe carry on a little bit today with is the fact that the hiding of a crime and the destruction of evidence is as criminal an act, both legally and morally, as it is to commit the crime in the first place. And we've had people, and this is all the churches, not just the Anglican, the Catholic, the United, any church that ran one of these death camps called the Indian Residential Schools, they have been allowed to destroy evidence, to hide documents, to silence witnesses, to obstruct justice, and they've done it with the collusion of the government of Canada and the Royal Canadian Mounted Police.
And we have paid for it. And we have paid for it, literally. We put the bill.
That's right.
And, during World War II, the Nazis had a lot of programs that were geared towards targeting of children, doing experimentation. And with the connection of the Catholic Church and involved in a lot of that, you can kind of see a streamlined connection between the two. And you can see how this plays out on so many different levels over so many different years and how it leads up to the present day and how this is still going on right now as we speak. It's just been kind of removed from the public spectrum in the way that communion is seen as this kind of fun time. You eat a wafer and drink some grape juice or some wine, and you're drinking the blood of Christ in a symbolic way. But what it really is a very, very open form of blood sacrifice and the consumption of flesh. But it's just done with wafer crackers and Welch's grape juice. It's getting people to partake in these types of rituals without even knowing it.
Yeah. So would you say, Ryan, that that's deliberate? I mean, is this a way to kind of program people that sacrifice and killing is somehow necessary? I mean, is it that overt, do you think?
Yeah, I actually think that there's a lot of layers to it, but that is probably one of the foremost layers. People for a long, long, long time historically have been open to that kind of, action by certain powerful members of society, whether they're involved in religious institutions, political institutions. And when I guess there's a kind of revolution of the mind and people begin to, and we've seen this just globally, as we move on into a new age, a new century, we kind of move away from certain actions. And as we move away, there are other people that are very much rooted in the past histories of how they've always acted. And the best example I can give you of this is there was an author, I can't remember his name, he wrote a book about the royal family over the centuries and how they have always just openly out in the public, it's always been a thing of the royal family to drink the blood of sacrificial victims and to eat their flesh, which is the form of communion. And yet, in the past 300 years, about since the end of the 1700s into the 1800s, they stopped doing this overtly. Now, I think it obviously still goes on behind the scenes, but 300 years ago, this was well known about, and then all of a sudden, it just stops. I have a hard time believing that people where, I mean, this is a family where I know the new royal baby was just born, right? It was a day after May Day, so right around the Beltane Festival and Walpurgis Night. And you had Prince William, his birth was induced on the summer solstice, exactly on the summer solstice. And his first child, George, was born on the Sothic Rising of Sirius, which is a high Egyptian Sumerian new year, which brought back the yearly inundation of the Nile, which was a symbol of rebirth to the Egyptians. And this new baby, they named, part of the name is Diana, which is another goddess. So there's a lot, the people that are so obsessed with names and dates and times, you really think that they stopped practicing these rituals? I think it would be crazy to think they stopped, as opposed to thinking it's crazy that they would do it at all.
Well, and the other thing, too, of course, is here's another piece in the puzzle. Some of the information I shared with you, you know, before the show, Ryan, about one of the psychic investigators who was with us at the Brentford School, the Mushroll, who had handled objects from the school, who was there, actually, when the soil was turned on the place that eyewitnesses had seen children buried. She described to us getting these really horrible impressions at the school of rituals going on beneath the basement, of people in red robes and red skull caps, of there being literally channels flowing with blood, and children being suspended from the wall and doing all, you know, all of these things that sound like something out of a horror movie. But she saw all this, you know, and she, of course, had been consulted by the police before. This was a credible person who had actually helped the police find bodies of missing Aboriginal women on the West Coast on Vancouver Island. So, you know, this is real. And did you or Laura have any comments about that stuff?
I do. Laura, do you have any comments about that before
go ahead,
I? Okay. No, well, I did some digging, Kevin, and I wrote in one of my books, The Grand Illusion, about topics of this nature. And in my new book also, which documents a lot of what we talk about, I really went into a lot of detail about this. And I've been doing more research on it recently, kind of piecing together the different pieces of the puzzle. And what I find is that going back, you look at Bohemian Grove, as you mentioned, these very elite members of society get together and they wear the same types of robes. They wear the red robes, the green robes, the yellow robes, in some cases blue robes. Each robe stands obviously symbolically for something. For example, green stands for nature, black stands for death, void of all colors. And if you look at the Druidic the Druidic order, which was a group of Celtic priests, they had three sacred colors they would wear in their robes when they would perform sacrificial rituals. These were the three sacred levels of the Druidic order, blue, green, and white robes. And what's important about white robes is white robes go all the way back into the most ancient of days. The Knights Templar wore white robes, the Cistercians, the Essenes, which was the sect that Jesus and John the Baptist were members of. Even in Central America, the god Quetzalcoatl was prophesied to return, and when he returned, he would return on a type of in a type of presence as Jesus would return on a white horse. That symbolism, Quetzalcoatl would return with a white robe. He had red crosses, which is likely the Templar cross that he wore. And also, I found this interesting, the Ku Klux Klan. Kuklos comes from a Greek word as pronounced, I think it's Kuklos, and it means circle. And the Ku Klux Klan actually used to be called the Knights of the Golden Circle. And, of course, the Golden Circle is this representation of the sun. And their logo would actually, it was like a golden sphere with a Maltese cross in the center. And the Maltese cross they wear is red. And you can see this actually on the pontifical outfits nowadays. And
well, if you relate...
Go ahead.
I'm sorry, but that's what the psychic was telling us, that she saw a lot of Vatican and Catholic presence, even though it was ostensibly an Anglican school. She saw, at the same time, records of these basically torture and experiments being done on children at the Brantford School, actually being stored in archives in Rome, in Vatican Library underground. And so, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but that Vatican link is you know, part of this as well as just the Church of England.
Yeah, it's important. It's vital. And I mean, I think that could actually kind of open up a whole new kind of psychological aspect to this, understanding that certain serial killers, and you see this even in television, serial killers take sometimes a trinket, an item from their victim. It's a type of trophy that they keep.
Right.
So it makes perfect sense to me if they were to keep, you know, bones of children or bones of their sacrificial victims for whatever purpose or reason. I mean, that's something that's well
right.
documented.
And also from an eyewitness, we have a woman on Vancouver Island whose uncle was a Catholic cardinal. And I remember sitting in her living room and talking to her about the day that he took her on a tour of underneath the Vatican Library. And she saw exactly that. She saw bones, skulls in the wall, those kind of things that were being held down there. So, I mean, this is not just, you know, science fiction stuff. It's very real, right?
No, it seems like it might be because the average person that you talk to on a daily basis, these are not the kind of things that are going through their mind. The people that we're talking about lack empathy. They can't relate to the average person. They can try to relate. They have to have media run some type of interference for them so that they can look like they relate to the average person when they don't.
Yeah.
And when you look at, like, let's say the Red Cross, or you were telling me about how there were these people performing the rituals had these, like, large silver crosses they were wearing.
That's right. She said that she's this huge, huge cross on them. It didn't even look real. It was so big, she said.
Yeah. Well, you know, a lot of people don't understand that there's a lot of symbolism here, so excuse me if I go in three or four directions at once. First of all, that cross is actually used at the Bohemian Grove in Sonoma County in California, where as they bring the effigy on a boat across the water, part of some type of symbolic journey, before they burn it on the Blackstone altar to Moloch the owl, which is a very important symbology that we could even get to. There are hundreds of silver crosses, big crosses, that they plant in the ground and they light them on fire. And that symbolism also is very prevalent, obviously, within the Ku Klux Klan as well. So you have the same kind of connections here. And when you look at that cross, or you look at specifically the Red Cross, that Red Cross is a symbol, for example, of the advanced African Phoenician culture. It's a symbol of the sun. It represents fire. It's actually the flag of St. George. And it also represents the color red, a shedding of the blood of Jesus, and a shedding of that blood so that as we consume that blood in these forms of communion and these rituals, that we have some form of everlasting life. And that symbology, I think, has been taken and it's been distorted from the concepts of the life-giving aspects right. of our solar sun, shedding its light, shedding those red, yellow rays on us, and us taking that and being able to have life because of it. And that gets taken right. and distorted in these rituals.
Ryan, this is all really valuable. I wanted to also mention that one of the people I was speaking to when we were doing the mushroom dig in Brantford, a man who had gone to the school, he had a friend called Joey Commanda, who was 13 years old. In September 1968, he was hit by a train trying to escape from the school, and they had to do work on his arm and everything. What happened was that and this isn't well known at all, his family brought a lawsuit against the Anglican Church for criminal negligence, and what happened was the government, for some reason, did an inquiry into their claim of criminal negligence. What they found caused them to shut down the mush hole. That's why the school closed the next year in 1970. The inquiry, according to this fellow, was closed when they began to reveal things that had gone on in the school, and it was directly because of this inquiry into what had happened to Joey Commanda and friends of his who had died, that they closed down the mush hole. Basically, they realized, holy shit, this stuff might come out. It's time to shut this thing down. And, you know, so I want people to know that this is a result of when you begin to surface things, they react. And looking at the reaction, you can measure things that often aren't stated.
That's exactly right. And you know what? I can give a really good example of what we are being able to uncover here and what we're being able to do as activists. There's a lot of companies, big time corporations nowadays, a lot of food companies that are removing ingredients from their food. A lot of companies have gone non-GMO. A lot of companies are trying to move into the organic label. And of course, some of them do it for money, but a lot of fast food places are removing certain ingredients from their food. And they're doing it because people are refusing to acquiesce and make purchases of those products anymore. And when people speak, these companies have to make a decision that if they want to make money, they have to do what the people actually say. And it's not even a mass of people, it's just a critical mass of a certain percentage. So when we talk about what we're talking about, as we are activists in this field, we can bring so much attention to this to the point where they have to almost come out and basically say it. I mean, when you get Bergoglio saying things like pedophilia is like a black mass, we acknowledge that there are this many pedophiles operating within the church. This is like open admittance of what they're doing. They just didn't say, okay, look, I did it. They're saying, look, we know what's going on.
Well, and as a matter of fact, they've had a lot of admissions like this. The point is, yeah, they'll admit things, but nothing ever happens because they run the courts. They run the system. And
yeah, exactly.
That's why where the common law courts come in, citizen convened courts that do have the power to imprison and arrest. And we're going to get into that in the second half of the show. We're near the bottom of the other hour. And one of the things I'd like you to listen to now, everyone, is something from Del Riley, who was a survivor of the Mohawk School in Brantford, something he shared with us during our investigations there a few years ago. And after that, there'll be a short little musical break, and we'll be back.
Here we are, second day of the dig, near the mush hole. And this is an area about 100 yards from the school, where we found consistent bone samples. And these regular types of buttons, probably off of, well, clothing, obviously. But the interesting thing is here and at the Glebe site, they're of the same style as if they're off a standard uniform or something. Could be a child's button off a school uniform.
My name is Del Riley. I'm a member of the Chippewa of the Thames. And I spent 5 years in the Canadian government calls the residential schools, but really these were prisoner of war camps. I was one in the one called the Mohawk Institute, and I do believe it had the reputation of being the worst of all the residential schools, if there is such a thing, because they were all horrible. But I did 5 years here, and it was a most horrific experience any human being could possibly go through. And probably from being every one of the 6-year-olds I was in here sexually abused, and myself as well, multiple times, and double-digit figures of every one of them. It happened to all of us. And they starved us, beat us, froze us, and it was horrific. There was no controls in the place. Kids were always getting beat up or being put through various torture rituals. Well, I want the story to come out. I want the world to know what has happened to the kids here. The fact that thousands upon thousands were killed here. It was a holocaust for our kids, and then have to suffer now through the fact that most of those little kids they killed off, nobody knows who they were, where they're buried, what home. So I don't know how we're going to deal with that, but we have to deal with that.
The other night, a voice came to me. Turned out it was God. Said, "Oaks, wake up. This is God here. Over." I said, "You're putting me on, of course, Dylan." So he did a few tricks. He moved the bed back and forth. Trembling, I asked, "What is it you want, O Lord?" He said, "Well, frankly, Phil, I went downtown the other day, saw the greatest story ever told, couldn't believe it. It's gone too far. Something must be done about Christianity. Then, woof, in a puff of smoke, he disappeared. The next morning I woke up, had a few drinks to realize it was all true, and decided to do something about Christianity. But what could I do, me, a poor, humble boy from the sticks? Then I remembered I was a songwriter. Aha, so I sat down with pen in hand over my typewriter and ended up writing this next song, which is a hymn about Christianity. Actually, an anti-hymn. The first anti-hymn, folks. That's the melody. Christian cannons have fired at my days, with a warning beneath the holy blaze, and bow to our authority, say the cannons of Christianity. Oh, the children will be sent to schools, minds of clay are molded to the rules, learn to fear.
And that's Phil Oakes, The Canons of Christianity, C-A-N-N-O-N-S, but also C-A-N-O-N-S, meaning body of teachings, but it also seems to correspond with that weapon. I wonder if that's an accident. Oh, well. We are here at Radio Free Canada every Sunday, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, www.bbsradio.com/Radio Free Canada. This is your voice. If you have ideas for programs, issues you want to broadcast and use as an organizing tool, contact us, republicofcanada@gmail.com, canadarepublic.ca. And we're back. Laurie, I wanted to ask you if you had anything you wanted to say from you being a songwriter and everything.
Yeah, music. Well, it's powerful because it reaches us at a different level than I've seen it many times when we've been in public together and you know you're speaking and giving lots of facts and stuff and people react in one way to that, but then I haul out a song and it just seems to hit. Mm-hmm. Emotionally in a way that they don't seem to react to the facts. And
yes.
So I think it's a powerful combination.
Yes, and you have written a number of incredibly moving songs about that, and maybe next week, because I don't want to put you on the spot, maybe you could sing one of them. I know, you know, it means a lot to me, especially because it mentions our friend William, so that would be wonderful. Oh, yeah. If you do that, yeah.
Okay, well, I'll either promise to go on either live or try and get that recorded this week.
Okay,
so.
Thank you.
Yeah, okay.
Ryan, you had a few more points you wanted to make before the break.
Oh, yeah, I've always got a lot of points. One of the things was about liberty, and we were talking about rights a little bit ago at the beginning of the show, and I wanted to make this comment because I think you both agree with me, is that one of the reasons we find it so difficult, at least I think, to get people to understand what's going on in so many different ways, not just about the child sacrificial cults, the trafficking of children and things like that, but is that people have been really conditioned to, first of all, not understand that they have some type of human rights. And the second thing is to understand that it's actually the very definition of patriotism to stand up and be dissentful. Those who do not dissent are the ones that have been run over by the tyrants. We've been programmed, really, I think, to believe that dissenting is somehow an act of terrorism. And yet we've been taught that true patriotism is just basically bowing down to whatever the authorities
right.
say.
Now, I'm glad you mentioned the T word, because I've seen an FBI bulletin and the RCMP and the BC Law Society put out a similar bulletin saying that anyone who is part of the movement called Freeman on the Land is considered a domestic terrorist. There's no such organization called Freemen on the Land. It's just kind of a slogan people use. All they're doing is, like Dean Clifford was doing, teaching people about the common law. That is a terroristic act now, officially, under the old regime.
That's how it works. They will label anybody a terrorist, a domestic terrorist, a violent extremist. And what they do is that if you look at the Department of Homeland Security in the states, they actually have a list that they've sent out through the FBI to local businesses. And some of the possible indicators of terrorist activity here, guys, is, I'm not making this up, wearing jeans. That's one of them.
Oh, well.
Sweating. And one of the big ones is paying with cash.
These
are
one.
On the official government list of possible terrorist activities. Sleeping on a park bench, the homeless people, that's considered an act of possible terrorists.
Right, you're terrorizing all those tourists. You're making them feel guilty. That's an act of terrorism.
It is. You know what's kind of funny is that we're kind of led to believe they try to these tyrants try to plant a seed of doubt in us and what we talk about and what we do, trying to bring their crimes out into the open. And they always like to use that word conspiracy theory. Everything you're talking about is just a conspiracy theory. But if you think about it for a second, wouldn't all the eyewitnesses and all of the victims who have come out and who have done documentaries with you and have done audio recordings and you've spoken with and documented what they've said, wouldn't you have to say that then there is also a conspiracy of victims to conspire to make all of this up? I mean, wouldn't that have to be also a valid argument?
Be pretty spectacular, yeah. Quite a coordinated effort.
Well, you know, that's been the case from the very beginning, because it's the people say, Kevin, why haven't they dragged your ass into court? I said, I would love it. Because think of what I could demand from the church and during discovery in a court setting. Think of what would be in the public record, these hundreds of eyewitnesses who've described these crimes, like Del Riley, who we just heard. And I wanted to mention something that he said. He said torture rituals. He didn't say torture. He said torture rituals. And in that clip, and by the way, people can see a lot of that at itccs.org. If you go to the masthead, there's 3.5 hours of testimonies that were used, in our conviction of these criminal bodies. And Dell's on there along with other people. But when he said torture rituals, one of the things he was describing is they would take kids and make them hold onto electric barbed wire fences. They'd go around and electrically shock them in the class as a group. And anyone who wasn't willing to be electric shocked was, you know, treated very badly. And as a matter of fact, Lorna McNaughton said that one of her friends was stuck in a closet and didn't come out alive. They just left her in there and she died in there. So, I mean, you know, when we say torture rituals, we got to take that literally.
Well, those are that type of electroshock was used in the Russian gulags, and it was also used at Abu Ghraib, the U.S. prison. And those are the different types of torture techniques. I'm sure there's a lot of reasons they use certain torture techniques, but the people that do it are really just sick. I mean, we can't look at these people as being like you and I, because they're not. And that's what's really hard for a lot of people to come to terms with, is that we're not looking at a regular human being. On the surface, they might look normal, but biologically, some type of chemical has mixed with something else in the brain, and some type of wire has been either reconnected to something that shouldn't be connected to, or has been snipped and has been disconnected. Or perhaps they are truly possessed by some type of mind control or some type of entity from another dimension. Who really knows? I mean, for sure, in every case.
Well, let me. I don't want to disagree with you, but I want to put in an oppositional note here, and that is, I think anyone can become a torturer. I think that 90% of humanity is capable of doing those things under the right circumstances, and that's what our enemy is. It isn't a small percentage of psychopaths. It's the fact that human beings are so adaptable that when they're in a system, not on their own, you know, you take somebody living on their own, they have a moral basis to them, right? You put them in an institutional setting, and their mind changes. The overmind, the higher, you know, the corporate mind, if you like, replaces their own individual morality. And this is the nature of a corporation. You're handing over moral authority to somebody else, and that way you're capable of committing crime as part of the group. That was recognized at the Nuremberg trials. Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, well, I mean, that's the whole thing around just taking orders, right?
Right,
yeah.
Just doing my job, taking orders, right? That's what that larger group think is. I mean, like, when you brought up Abu Ghraib, and, you know, all those pictures of all those very young soldiers doing all that shit, you know, they those aren't a group of psychopaths that they chose. Those were a bunch of regular soldiers, and in that situation, encouraged to behave that way, and things get out of hand, like, you know.
Yeah, it becomes a crime to follow your own conscience. That's the corporate reality we're all living under. So we stand up and say, it doesn't matter who you are, Pope, King, President, you're under the law. That's common law. You're not higher than the law. We simply try to apply that, and we become the criminal.
Well, you're exactly right. I mean, and I'm not rooted to my beliefs, so I'm absolutely on board with what you both are saying. And I think that actually relates to what I was mentioning when we first came back from break about how we've been taught that standing for liberty is a form of terrorism, and that being dissentful is a form of terrorism, and that only by listening to those in authority is a true act of patriotism and standing for your country, when in fact it's the very opposite. So yeah, it's part of that corporate herd, profane prole mentality that people are just conditioned and brainwashed. Right. And I agree, in certain situations, that's exactly how humans will react. It's kind of like that movie Men in Black, when Tommy Lee said that, you know, a person is smart, but people are, you know, insecure, and people are, you know, right, constantly worried about things.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Well, that's why when we talk about what would a new society look like, we have to decorporatize our thinking from an individual basis, but also create a new collectivity that isn't based on the corporate model, but the common law model that says every man and woman is sovereign. That means they're the source of law and authority. It says that in the American Constitution, so we're not being particularly radical here. We're just quoting the things that are. As for that, I wanted to throw another thing. Since we are talking to the people in London who are doing this campaign to confront the Anglican Church over their crimes, where are the 20 sealed boxes? We have it from archivists in the Anglican system that when the lawsuits began against the Anglican Church, brought by people like Del Riley, who were tortured as a child by Anglican priests, the lawyer showed up one day with 20 sealed boxes. Now, we know Leona Moses, the former researcher, said that in these sealed boxes was what she called a smoking gun document from 1870, a signed contract between the Crown of England, the New England Company, and the Six Nations Confederacy, saying that the Brantford School would be used to wipe out the Mohawk Nation, because they were the ones who weren't playing ball. They were the one nation who weren't signing over their land to the Crown on a regular basis. They were targeted. Their children were targeted by this document. It's in the 20 sealed boxes, according to Leona Moses. When the lawyer showed up to go through the boxes, everybody had to leave. Everybody was sworn to silence. Now these boxes have disappeared. The people in the Toronto archives say they don't know where they are. The people in London say they were sent to Toronto. They are also sent to the TRC, the Truth and Reconciliation government spin operation in Winnipeg. But everybody, when you call these places, nobody seems to know where the boxes are. So this is part of this fraud going on that we're confronting, and people act like that when they're guilty and they have a lot to hide.
Yeah, they absolutely do. You see that on all levels, whether it's a local level or it's a state level or it's a federal, international level. I wanted to also mention to you, because we were talking before the show and I did a little bit of research into the color red and why red was important in terms of why it was being used as a robe that was worn in some of these sacrifices, if that's an area that you'd like to get into real quick.
Oh, sure. Please do.
So, like I was mentioning, you know, as the concept of Jesus shedding his blood for mankind and, you know, giving us eternal life through the consumption of his blood in these overt forms of communion, these rituals, it's the same way that the sun, S-U-N, not S-O-N, sheds its light on us, and we are able to obtain nutrients and certain vitamins from the sun, and it gives us it gives us life. It's a form of life force. And those two words are important because occultists for thousands of years and many ancient cultures believe that the blood of a human being, or even the blood of an animal that was in some cases used in ritual forms of divination to tell the future, that blood contained the life force of a person. And in fact, a lot of the ancients, Greeks, Egyptians, the Mayans, they all believed that the blood was actually the carrier of disease. So they practiced something called bloodletting. This is actually what led to George Washington's death, is that he fell off a horse and they let out like a liter and a half of blood and he ended up dying from infection. But the life force that's contained in the blood, what is supposed to contain the most potent life force is female menstrual blood. And I know people think that this might get into an area like, oh, you guys are disgusting. But I mean, this is really the reality of what we're dealing with. These people believe that menstrual blood, of whether it's a human or if it's an animal, contains the strongest form of life force that is in existence, and that by mixing that with fresh oxygen, such as in tree groves like the Bohemian Grove, that fresh oxygen makes that life force even more potent. So when you drink it, you're obtaining this new form of energy.
And that would apply. That would apply to the blood of newborn babies, correct?
Absolutely. I mean, that's the whole concept of that, is the innocent. And when they say virgin doesn't necessarily mean some young 18-year-old girl who's never had sex with anybody. Typically, a virgin means pure blood. It typically means an infant or a child. And this was actually portrayed in the movie Pan's Labyrinth, which had a lot of female symbolism, a lot of satanic symbolism, but not like it was promoting that. It was just a lot of mythology. And at the very end, she had to sacrifice herself, basically. She slit, I think, her hand and dropped her sacrificial blood instead of sacrificing her little baby brother.
Well, Ryan, you know, an interesting thing, too, when we grow up here on Turtle Island, here in North America, we're given this expression about when our ancestors came here, they found no one, first of all. It was a virgin land. You always get that, virgin mm-hmm. land. So it applies in the broader scheme as well. We're not just talking about sacrifice of individuals, but of whole cultures and of whole lands.
You know, they throw that term around a lot. They throw the virgin and they throw the whore around a lot. Didn't you? I don't know if you guys find it interesting that Mother Mary, Mary Magdalene, which was a newer version of the goddess Rey, mm-hmm. when Rey was incorporated into the Roman cults, where Rey, and they put Ma as in the mother before that, Ma Rey became Mary. And Mary had lots of children. Jesus had brothers and sisters, mm-hmm. and therefore she wouldn't be a virgin, but they still look at her and they portray her in that context. And what's really important about that is this, and let me kind of tie that in with the life force of the blood. If you look at the concept of blood, blood has the, because it's considered to be red, and that's a symbol of sexuality and so many other things, red has the longest wavelength, and it is next to black on the color spectrum in this version of white light, what we see as reality, which is only a small portion of what actually exists. The color of red, if you break it down, the German word rot means red, and there's a variation of rot and right, which comes from ritual, and what this really is there's a deity called the Scarlet Woman. She's also known as the Whore of Babylon. And this is a perversion. It's a double perversion, in my opinion, because it's a perversion of what many would call Mother Mary or Lady Diana, if you will, the different forms of the goddess, where these symbolisms have been already perverted. And then when people like me, people like you come and we bring these back into the public spectrum, people have been trained to believe that these are demonic, when in fact these are the true forms of positivity. These are the true forms of divinity. And what I mean by that is, if you take the Scarlet Woman, scarlet also another way that you can say red, it's a version of color. And the Scarlet Woman was actually known as basically the angel Gabriel, the mother goddess. And in the Garden of Eden, the first woman in the garden, her name was Lilith. And because she, and this is the most important part, because she refused to be submissive sexually to man, God cast her out of the garden in the mythology. And instead of becoming, a goddess of life-giving qualities, a goddess of nurturement, she became betrayed by those in these religious sects, if you will, as the goddess of abortion and sacrifice. And blood sacrifice.
Ryan, I want you to hold that. We've got only about 3 to 4 minutes left, unfortunately, our hour-long show. I want to carry this on because it provides some of the mindset for why these sacrifices and crimes went on and continue to go on within a religious context, right? Since we're talking about religious-based genocide. So I want you to kind of hold that, if you don't mind, and ask, first of all, if either of you have any final comments, because I've got a couple of announcements.
I think that I'm good. Lori, what about you?
Yep, definitely. I'm fine. I just want to continue on the conversation, but we'll have to wait till next week.
Good, yeah. We will. The one thing I wanted to mention that I hadn't before was the folks in London who are over the next few weeks going to be mounting these first public actions against the Anglican Church. They're looking for solidarity actions to occur in Vancouver, in Toronto, in Winnipeg, in Ottawa, and London, England. And if you're able to help out, that means handing out flyers at churches, helping reclaim church property, which is criminal, by the way. Don't forget, under international law, convicted criminal organization do not have the right to their own assets or property anymore because they're being used for criminal purposes. So you have every right to go in and occupy churches peacefully and take them back. People that are planning that who want to be part of these direct actions as well as the education work, please contact us, republicofkanata@gmail.com. And also we have a whole new front building here, which is a group that is attempting to find out, like I mentioned before, the Achilles heels of these church corporations. Who insure them? Who provide the insurance liability, which is, after all, their God? It's the one thing they were concerned about in the court proceedings brought against them, the Catholic, Anglican, and the United Churches, that they not lose their insurance coverage, because that's everything to them. You know, and so this is a whole new thing we're looking into and grabbing that Achilles heel. If you have more information on that, we've started a whole research group onto that. So again, contact us if you'd like to be part of that. This is, unfortunately, we only have an hour, but we'll work on that. And we need at least double the amount of time to do this justice in a week with everything developing. But I appreciate everybody's you know, the rising listenership we have on this show. Every Sunday here at 6 p.m. Eastern, please tune in again next week. And we're going to close with a final song by Dear Phil Oakes. And it says, well, you know, it says a lot for what I'm thinking these days personally, but that's what happens when you reach 60, right? After 20 years of this work. But anyway, it's a beautiful song, When I'm Gone. And I appreciate everybody tuning in. We'll again be in touch during the week and next week on the air. Thank you all.
There's no place in this world where I belong.